Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. For years, David McCauley has delighted and informed children, adults, and armchair architects everywhere with his painstakingly detailed pen and ink books. His show-and-tell volumes detail the building of public structures, pyramids, mills, bridges, a Roman city, skyscrapers, even tunnels. In 1973, he published his first book, Cathedral. 30 years later, Mosque has just hit the bookstands. Tonight on Point, David McCauley and what we learn from the structures we create. We begin in Washington, where senators debating over some of President Bush's judicial nominees have dragged in the cots for an all-night talkathon.
The minority is thwarting the will of the majority, that the consequences are significant for the country.
We had no choice. Either we could be a rubber stamp, or we could do whatever means, the only means we had in our disposal to stop the president from getting every nominee.
It's called representative government. Yeah, if you lose a lot of presidential elections in a row, there's going to be an imbalance on the federal bench. That's the way it happened.
This side did not resort to the filibuster as a tool of the opposition, as the Democrats have. There can be no debate about that.
There's enough blame to go around, and the last thing I want is a 30-hour blame-a-thon, and I don't want to participate in that.
It is the Senate's first all-nighter in 9 years, and senators are willing to talk themselves hoarse and into the wee hours to make their points over the issue of Democrats blocking some of President Bush's judicial nominees. Gail Chaddick is a congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked her when the session started and how long it's likely to last.
Well, it started at 6 p.m. Wednesday night, and they're a little uncertain about when it ends. They're going to have, first thing on Friday morning, three cloture votes, which they expect to fail. Then they'll follow that up with a vote to change the rules. And then I think if you counted out the 30 hours, it would actually take you, later into the afternoon. But they're not really committed to the full 30.
And what are they doing to fill the time? I mean, are they standing there and reading recipes or what?
The Democrats have half the time, so they're spending their half saying how ridiculous it is to be focused on four jobs when the country has lost 3 million, and otherwise making a case about priorities. What does it say about priorities that we're spending all this time on judges? And I think Republicans are pretty much staying to the script. They have blocked out a number of themes that they want to hit, including, racism, obstructionism, anti-religious bias, the unprecedented use of the filibuster and so forth. They feel that they have a strong case.
I'm confused about the terminology.
Yes.
What is the difference? This is being called a talkathon. What is the difference between a filibuster and a talkathon?
Well, a filibuster is something the minority is supposed to do. There's been no example that anyone can think of a filibuster, choreographed by the majority. I mean, the point of a filibuster is to hold the floor. Well, the majority has the floor. They are, by right of recognition, you control the floor. That's not appropriate. It's also, as Republicans themselves say, a filibuster, you're against something. You want to block something from happening. What Republicans want is for something to happen. They want votes.
The Democrats are saying, hey, we've confirmed 168 of these judicial nominees. We're only holding up four. Since when does this have to be unanimous? I mean, is the Bush administration looking for a rubber stamp here, as the Democrats are charging?
I don't think so. I think this really goes back to a very interesting hearing that Senator Schumer had when the Democrats took back the Senate, in which he just said ideology is a legitimate factor in choosing judges. Now, that's always been true, but no one has ever said it before. I mean, typically you say that a judge is chosen on the basis of qualifications and judicial temperament, period. You don't go in and do a litmus test on how you feel about abortion, how do you feel about, using the federal government to help Hispanics and so forth. But those are the kinds of issues that have come up in, for example, the case of Miguel Estrada. Has he done enough to help Hispanics? That's something that Republicans say just isn't a legitimate question.
And what are some of the views of these unapproved four nominees?
The arguments that are looked on especially, thinking of Janice Rogers Brown, was whether she is too much of a judicial activist in that she would roll back many of the things that the federal government has done for African Americans, for example. Chuck Pickering, there was some concern about what he had done concerning a cross-burning case. He had intervened on behalf of a more lenient sentence, and that was taken by, especially by people outside the state, as someone who was clearly a racist. But for civil rights groups inside the state, there was a lot of support for him because he had also, as a young prosecutor, I think in 67, gone after the Klan, testified against a Klansman, which was a very courageous thing to do. So you have some suggestion that Halle Barber just became governor of Mississippi in part over resentment over how a Mississippi judge was dealt with by Democrats in the Senate. So it is possible that these lower court, you know, appointments that really haven't gotten that much public attention before can become a campaign issue.
And finally, Gail, what will have to happen for this talkathon to end? Does somebody have to call the question, or do they just stop talking and sit down?
I think they have pretty much determined when it's going to end, although there's no specific date. Someone will just make a motion to adjourn, and no one will object. I think they're not planning on doing anything else before leaving for the weekend.
And you'll be there till the bitter end?
Always.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for being with us.
Great.
Gail Chadwick is a congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Washington. The idea for David McCauley's latest book, Mosque, was hatched before September 11th of 2001, but the attacks gave new life to an idea that had long intrigued him, a how-did-they-do-that look at some of the world's most thrilling buildings. Following the template laid out by his popular books Cathedral and Castle, McCauley's latest offering narrates the creation of a mosque. His account of a fictional but typical mosque follows the politics, planning, and process of construction and delves both into Islamic tradition and the cosmopolitan makeup of Istanbul in the 16th century. So we're asking this hour, what do buildings mean to you? What does architecture teach us about communities and the people who inhabit them? Is modern architecture less connected to the people who live and work in it than the mosques, cathedrals, and cities David McCauley describes? Or have his depictions of skyscrapers and tunnels shown you that these structures, too, have soul and meaning? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And for a look at some of the illustrations from Mosque, David McCauley's latest book, you can go to our website at onpointradio.org. And joining me now in the studio is David McCauley, author and illustrator. His new book is Mosque. Welcome. It's such a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks very much.
You know, David, you have covered so much ground with your books over the years, from explaining how things like bridges and tunnels work to how cities evolve over time. So give us a little bit of the background as to what exactly beyond September 11th, that was certainly part of it, but there's perhaps more as well. You know, why a mosque book and why now?
Well, why a mosque book now? It does have a lot to do with September 11th. You know, after watching that extraordinary day of television, I was left, like many people, wondering, what do you do? How did this happen? How do we get here? And what do I do about it? Rather than simply pace around and rub my hands together, I thought, well, why don't I do what I do, which is to provide some information about something that has always interested me, this piece of architecture, this collection of pieces of architecture associated with Islam, in Ottoman Turkey, of Ottoman Turkey. And it just seemed like the right thing to do immediately. So I called my editor and I said, listen, I think I have to stop what I'm working on and just get going on this. And what do you think? We talked about it. He was a little nervous. Neither of us wanted to jump on any kind of bandwagon. But I think that there was a sense that some kind of information on whatever level, if everybody who could contribute information to this gaping hole in our knowledge of the rest of the world, They should, and we'd be better off. I see my books as books on middle school library shelves and in people's houses and so on and so forth, shared by children and parents. And I thought this was a perfect opportunity to add something to the cathedrals, and castle, and pyramid, the stuff we've westernized that maybe seems a little foreign, seems a little strange, and therefore encourages perhaps fear.
Well, one of the things I've always appreciated about your work is that you make it easy enough for a grown-up to understand and to follow. You know, it's not just not just for the kids, it's also for the grown-ups. But I was intrigued by the question of why, in this instance and in some of your other work, why is it a fictional mosque?
That's very easy. I'm not an academic. I'm not a scholar. I do read the footnotes because they often have interesting information in them, but I don't want to get tangled up in footnotes. My job is to tell a story, is to use all the work that all those other people, thank goodness, have done over the years, pick my pieces, paste them together in some sort of a logical way in order to create a picture of a time using architecture as the sort of structure, not only as the main character in the story, but as the structure of the story itself. And there's a wonderful logic to any piece of architecture. And there are the broader implications of it.
Well, and in fact, I was struck in reading Mosque, something that I had never heard of before, that Islamic law prevents parents from passing their entire estates along to their children. So I have to imagine that that's one of the reasons why mosques like the one you describe were built. This was sort of the contribution of the community.
And were built in a very short period of time. It's an interesting comparison when you look at the Gothic cathedrals, where they continually seem to run out of money. And therefore had to drag the old bones and bits and pieces out of the vault and put them on the road to see if they could raise some funds. The Ottomans didn't have to worry about that. They were enormously wealthy. And since charity is one of those five pillars of Islam that you hear so much about, it was definitely a motivating factor in the creation of not just the religious building, the central building, but of the surrounding buildings that served the needs of a much larger community in a much more sort of practical way.
And I think for a lot of people that's another aha moment, because I'm not sure how many of us in the West realize that, you know, you might know that this was a center of religious life, but not that there were bathhouses and soup kitchens and lodgings for travelers.
And hospitals, libraries, school, whatever was needed. And these things were being built. The reason the Ottoman sort of idea is such a rich one to work from is that Istanbul itself had been, you know, up until the invasion in 1453, I think it was, the city was really down and out. And there was a tremendous amount of rebuilding to do if Istanbul was ever to reach its reattain the glory it had once known as Constantinople and Byzantium. And, you know, encouraging, as the Sultan, his viziers and his ministers to spend their fortunes establishing these foundations in order to sort of repopulate various neighborhoods that were perhaps more in need than other neighborhoods of this kind of urban development, seemed like a perfectly logical thing to do. And it served everybody's best interests and needs.
And what struck you most as you looked at how carefully and thoughtfully these buildings were designed and put together?
Well, there are a couple of things. The oddest thing, you know, at first glance, is perhaps that sense of trying to put round roofs over square buildings. I mean, all the rooms are basically square rooms, whether they're large, this large central space of the prayer hall, whether they're the dormitory rooms of the madrasa, whether they're the kitchens of the imaret. They're all square rooms, and they all have domes on them. They all have round roofs. And this it's an engineering thing, but it's really sort of logical, and that's one of the things that connects us to it, that makes it so accessible and so enjoyable to understand. How do you go about establishing the relationship between this cube and this hemisphere? And it's a very simple device, whether it's piers that sort of surround the square space, as in the prayer hall, that are then connected by a ring of arches to create the beginnings of the base upon which the hemisphere then sits, or whether it's just the square, high, solid walls of the imaret, let's say, the soup kitchen, where you fill in the corners in order to create the circular base.
We're talking this hour with the author and illustrator David McCauley. What have you learned from his books about how buildings and bridges and tunnels are put together and the way things work? What structure would you like for him to tackle next? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour with David McCauley about his prolific career as a writer and illustrator. His latest book, Mosque, details the construction of a fictional mosque in 16th century Istanbul. And you can view images from Mosque on our website at oneonpointradio.org. And it also prompts the question to you of what do you see in the construction of a mosque or a cathedral or a Roman temple? When inspired by faith, do we create buildings that are more beautiful than others? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with David McCauley. One of the things that really strikes me in looking at your illustrations and in thinking about all the craftsmanship and the effort that went into these buildings. You know, it almost makes you think that Darwin got it backward. You know, they didn't have all the modern tools that we do. And look at the beautiful things they created.
That's one of the things that makes them so accessible. It's not hidden. Stuff isn't in black boxes when we look at these old buildings. I mean, you can see the blocks of stone of which the walls are made. You can see how the blocks of stone are cut into and shaped into piers and columns and arches. And you can see the skeleton that begins to grow and emerge. But you never lose track of the cells, in a sense, of the individual pieces of which the skeleton is made. And it's incredibly inviting. It's incredibly reassuring. But in fact, it doesn't take away from the awe that these structures can often inspire.
And you also make the point that at several places along the way, things would stop. Presents would be distributed to the workers.
Yeah.
Don't see much of that these days.
No. You've got to keep the spirits up of the workers. And it was part of this this sense of goodwill. I mean, even the notion of the admiral, who was the man who endows this foundation, having the bathhouse begun at the same time as the prayer hall, thinking again of the workers, of the sort of the welfare of the people, who will, if treated well, perform well in the creation of this structure and this complex.
And no doubt feel part of something much larger than themselves.
I think so. And I think that's true with all of those buildings, whether it be pyramid, whether it be cathedral, mosque. They're all very similar in a way and drawn to this effort by a larger idea.
When I look at your illustrations, and they are so amazingly detailed, and I try to imagine what it looks like when you're at work. I mean, are you hunched over a drafting bench and just, you know, getting out your colored pencils? And this was the first book that you've done in color. You know, do you have music going on in the background or what are you doing? Are you creating your own world as you're sitting there?
The studio is a bit of a mess when I'm in the middle of a project. What happens is my drawing board seems to shrink during the course of the project. And I start with a lot of wide open space, but I come down to this sort of 2-foot square area in which everything seems to happen. And I'm drawing on tracing paper, and I'm drawing little sketches. I'm drawing on the backs of envelopes. I'm thinking about it before I go to sleep, because once you start one of these projects, it doesn't quit until it's over, until you've turned everything over to somebody who will somehow turn it into a book. There are books around. There are now increasingly videos and things like that. The TV is right there because I need to watch the video of lead sheet makers or watch somebody working in the quarry. I'm lucky enough to have this kind of research now, stuff I never had when I did Cathedral back in 72, 73. So the sources and the means of getting at those sources are all around me the whole time. Plus, I travel. I go and see these places. I'm on the phone or emailing to my friends in Istanbul now for reactions to specific ideas and directions. It's an extraordinarily complex process, but it results, if it works, it results in a fairly simple, straightforward little story.
Do you view yourself primarily as a writer or an illustrator?
Yes.
Okay. Well, then which comes first?
Neither. I don't separate them. I will scribble some words, and I will be making little drawings on the same page in the sketchbook. And as much as possible, I like to see those two things growing side by side. It's the only way I can, you know, sort of efficiently come to the synthesis of words and pictures, which is what I'm trying to do from the beginning. I would like you to never know clearly whether or not a particular piece of information came from a picture or came from a paragraph.
Let's go to our phone lines now and hear from Dan, who's calling from Boston. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the program.
How you doing? I guess my question is, I'm wondering if Mr. McCauley has ever thought about, how many of his books have somewhat of a religious theme. He wrote a book about a cathedral, about pyramids, this one about a mosque, and I suppose my thought is that even the skyscraper is a book about, human yearning for something greater.
Cathedral of Commerce, as it was called.
And also, Tower of Babel, maybe, yearning to stretch into the
That's pretty close. No, I have thought about it, and it's interesting that the first book should be about the building of a Gothic cathedral. They are just such inspiring structures. In doing Mosque, 30 years later, it struck me that while the description of the architecture, the kind of space, the forms were considerably different from those of the cathedral, it was not a totally different story. And in fact, the need for a logical process in the quest of this kind of house of worship or a place just to pray, whatever it was, are very similar. I mean, there are two structures that are totally different looking, but in a sense kind of describe the similarities that all humans are capable of. That's that sort of ability to sort of reach beyond their physical limitations and their technological limitations and create something quite extraordinary.
Dan, do you have a favorite among David's books?
No, I like them all. I can't see into their...
Good answer.
Very good answer. Thank you so much
Thank
for the
call.
Thanks, Dan. Is it much more difficult working in color?
It's more complicated. I don't know that it's more difficult. It takes more time, which I misjudged, which is why I was very late with this book. But you do it differently. I mean, some of the drawings in Mosque are clearly pen and ink drawings with color added to them. And I started with that idea because I wanted the book to have some kind of a visual link to Cathedral and to the early books. And then I began to think, this is silly. I mean, you don't work with color over black lines. If you're going to work with color, you work with color. So what you will see in Mosque is the black lines soften and they go from ink to pencil and then they sort of disappear into the color so that the color takes over the job of describing form, describing light, and describing the architecture. It's a change that happened over the months that I was actually working on those drawings.
You didn't start out saying this is going to be in color? That was something
No,
that
I
came
knew
to
it was
later.
Going to be in color because once you've entered a mosque, even the smaller mosques, and seen the Isnik tiles and the paintings and so on and so forth, to leave this out would have just been impossible.
And do you think that those colors are so beautiful and so stunning because you think what's around them, a lot of dust, a lot of... sort of drabness outside, I would think. Now, I haven't been there. You have.
The
so
exteriors,
perhaps you can set me straight
Well,
on
the
this.
Exteriors of the buildings are quite somber. I mean, gray stone, much of it. Carved stone in the capitals of the columns of the courtyard, for instance. But it's not until you get inside that there's this sudden explosion of color. And it's really, it's an astounding thing. And in the book, I tried, while it's all in color, I really tried to build up those four spreads when we enter the cathedral, when we enter the mosque for the inauguration of the prayer hall. And I wanted that to be the sort of high point of the book. And I sort of tried to tone things down a little bit so that when we got inside the building and saw the color for the first time, we would have a little bit, perhaps, of that experience.
And I think the color gives you a renewed appreciation for the level of craftsmanship that went into these buildings.
Yeah, and I had no knowledge of this, really, until going back there the second or third time and looking more closely at the individual tiles themselves. I mean, you can just keep walking towards a wall of tiles, and it never becomes uninteresting or I mean, the detail is there no matter how far from the wall you are or how close to it you get.
Would it be even possible to do what you do without the training that you had as an architect?
It would be. I think that you would think about it differently. You would come at it differently. I come at it as an architect, so I really enjoy the logic of putting one thing on top of another, of figuring out what you're trying to do to begin. What is the purpose of this layout of buildings? What is the purpose of each building? Why should it look this way? And then how do you get there? You're building with stone and with brick, and you're having to deal with an earthquake area. You're having to deal with wind when you get up to a certain height. You're having to deal with all kinds of limitations. And, you know, there's a logical sort of sequence of events that has to be followed in order to reach a conclusion. And that's what I learned by studying architecture. You begin to look at the problems first. And as you start to piece the problems together, you begin to see the answers.
And how did this all begin for you? How did you go from being David, architecture student? Were you actually an architect for a while and then moved into the writing and the illustrating?
No, I was an architect for 2 months, one summer. It seemed like about 2 years. And I said to myself, as a fourth-year architecture student, I don't want to do this. I don't think this is the profession for me, but I loved studying architecture. What I got at the School of Design was an amazing look into problem solving that seemed right for me. But that wasn't the way I wanted to use that knowledge of problem solving. I didn't know quite what the way was. But my fifth year, I spent in Rome in the European Honors Program. And when I came back from it, I was going to look for other things. And I started freelancing, doing menu covers, anything anybody would, you know, offer to print, pretty much, I would draw. And started to illustrate some stories and then came up with this story for a gargoyle beauty pageant. I think because I wanted to draw the cathedral and have a story that was set logically, in, if you can call it logical, in the Middle Ages. And it was a drawing from that idea that of a half-finished cathedral with my little characters in front of it going towards their fantasy gargoyles that began the conversation, and I was encouraged to get rid of the gargoyles, because we have plenty of those, and just focus on the building. And that was the beginning. I went back to architecture, not knowing that that's where I was going to go, and I found a way of drawing on what little I knew of it to create the first book and then the second book and so on.
And have you been surprised by how people have reacted to your work over the years?
I've been delighted. I mean, I don't know that I've been surprised because I didn't know what to expect myself. Just delighted. It is unnerving when I have people come up to me and they are architects now or they're designers and they tell me that they grew up with my books, because I did.
Through the years, as you've been doing the writing and the illustrating, have there ever been moments when you've looked at modern architecture and thought, well, I could do better than that? Ever a temptation to go back and design a building of your own?
No, I'm not really tempted by it. And it would be easy to say I could do better than that. It's very complicated. It's a very complicated business. And when you think about the number of people you're working for when you set out to create a building, I mean, the client is one of them, or the clients. And then there are all those people in the process of designing the review panels, the neighborhood people, and so on and so forth. I mean, you have to become a consummate politician, I would imagine, and a tremendously gifted compromiser to pull one of these things off. Now, I don't like a lot of what I see, but I would never sort of suggest that I could do it better.
Do you think, though, that modern-day architects bring a different sensibility to their work? You were just talking about the compromises that they often have to make. I have to imagine that the people who were building the mosques didn't have design committees that they had to work through, although maybe not. I mean, did they have the same kind of issues that
Well, the form was established, the form of the mosque, you know, the sort of square, the squares, the cubes, the hemispherical domes, and so on and so forth. That was pretty much established. It was how it was used and the scales to which it rose. You're building with stone and with brick, and there are certain built-in limitations to those materials. Nowadays, it would seem almost anything is possible in terms of the kinds of materials, whether it's steel or the plastics and so on and so forth. You could sort of build out of anything. And with the use of the computer and the kind of technology that's available for streamlining the design process, for being really efficient and economical, it sort of changes everything, and it creates an architecture that can seem more remote, colder, less inviting, perhaps, than the older stuff. It seems less concerned with recognizing human scale, which is probably its biggest single weakness.
I'm curious to know what our listeners think about modern architecture. If you'd like to join the conversation, you'd be welcome to. You can call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You also had a remarkable opportunity to explain to the world about how things work through a PBS series. How did that come along?
Are we on The Way Things Work or Building Big?
I mean,
the engineering series. It came about because the people who have done the films based on Cathedral and Castle and City over the years got ambitious. Larry Klein, the producer, decided it was time to tackle engineering stuff and wanted me involved and wanted me to present it, and had gotten used to seeing me fumble around in front of the camera with my drawing pad, drawing upside down while trying to remember my lines. And I think he's sort of amused by that.
But that would be a challenge.
It was a challenge. It's always a challenge. And there was, so what happened was the sort of chunks of engineering, whether skyscraper, dams, domes, tunnels, they got sort of worked into separate films. And I was, you know, given the opportunity to travel around, look at these, begin to understand them myself, explain them. And then after the fact, I did a book to accompany the series, which had not been my original intent. But to learn that stuff, to get into those places, to sort of feel and see firsthand the scale of the Itaipu Dam, for instance, in Brazil, it's a phenomenal structure. I mean, bigger, it's almost impossible to comprehend the scale of that thing. To be on the window washing platform of the World Trade Towers, filming and talking about, you know, the sort of skyline in the distance and that sense of compression, compacting 200 acres of whatever it is of floor space that those buildings contained into just, you know, a fraction of that. And the technology required to make sure, you know, it stood until it couldn't. The opportunities are really remarkable, and you do find yourself making comparisons and connections between the old and the new. And, of course, you have your favorites. I mean, with Skyscraper, we went to San Gimignano and looked at, again at the sort of stone towers of this medieval town. Maybe the first skyscrapers, although these towers sprung up all over Italy in an unstable political climate. It was a good thing to have a tower for you and your family to hide in when necessary. And San Gimignano is the best example of the remaining towers from that way of thinking.
Or in City, I was fascinated by how the growth was all carefully planned and laid out, and then it followed the roads. Mm. You know, there's great logic to that.
There is. And it's interesting that, of course, that planning comes from Mother Rome, in which none of that planning seems to have ever taken hold. I mean, they could do what they wanted. It grew up in a sort of a random, organic way. And yet when they decided to create a colonial city somewhere in the empire, there was a grid. There were crossroads so that anybody anywhere in the empire would know what to expect once they passed through the gates of the wall and would feel at home.
Hmm. We're talking with David McCauley this hour, the writer and artist, about his book, his many books, actually, and The Way Things Work. His newest work is called Mosque. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about buildings and structures and the way things work. Which was your favorite McCauley book? Which one would you like to see in the future? Also, what buildings have inspired you to dream, to explore their creation, or to imagine the people who built them? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with David McCauley. And we want to get some of our listeners in on the conversation, David. Let's go first to Providence, Rhode Island, where you are now. Actually, not where you are right this second, but where you're living right now and working. And let's hear from Ed. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I'd like to talk to David. My son had his book, how things work, and he was pretty intrigued with that, but that's not why I'm calling. I'm a classmate from Cumberland High School in 1964, David McCauley, and I was kind of like the class clown, and David was more or less the class artist with a little clown in him, because I can remember sitting in class not too far from David, and he'd draw these caricatures of teachers with, you know, little bodies and remarkable lifelike heads, and pretty much to the amusement of a lot of people in class. So I just wanted to bring that up as a little sideline to David's, his ability to, his drawing ability was way back.
I used it.
Way before architectural stuff, I guess.
You're right, Ed. I used it a lot, especially in high school, because it was a way of showing off is what it was. And, like many people and kids in high school, I think you're looking for some kind of identity, something that is your own. And so I didn't hesitate. It was the Beatles I drew mostly.
Thanks very much for the call, Ed. Appreciate it. And let's go now to Tom, who's on the line from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom.
Good evening. I had a question for Mr. McCauley regarding his research on mosque. Sinan the architect did quite a bit of the building in this same period. And did you discover how he was able to get his designs transferred into reality? I mean, what was the process?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, I mean, Sinan basically invented Ottoman architecture and built hundreds of buildings, obviously many mosques among them. There are a number of accounts, Sinan's own accounts, of this building process. He describes the problems that were encountered along the way. They weren't money problems. They were sort of other things that sort of got in the way, whether it was winter months or maybe a shortage of stone or something like that. And he describes also having to defend the process to the Sultan, who was often impatient with how long it took to, for instance, build the foundations of the Suleimania and that sort of thing. I think the process was pretty much the way the process always is. I mean, he was the head of the Royal Architectural Office, so he would have had other architects working for him and other engineers. There was no shortage of labor. And in fact, one of the most interesting things to me about this whole thing was the huge percentage of the labor force that was Christian, as was Sinan himself before he was taken in the way that the Ottomans did as a young boy, basically, and brought into the Ottoman society and eventually converted to Islam. I don't know whether that answers your question or not, but I don't think the process is that much different than the process by which any piece of architecture would see the light of day.
Reliance more on models than drawings at that time?
There appears to be, although the images of models that we see tend to be models built for processions and not for describing to the client what the building is going to look like. So I took a liberty with that in the book. And for those people who are less comfortable understanding from a floor plan what they're seeing, I created a model next to the floor plan as if the client was being shown this model. But it's really based on the model of the Suleimania that was built apparently for some grand procession that wound its way through the streets of the city.
Tom, thank you so much for the call. That raises another point in my mind, because your pictures do make things beautifully clear, but it also requires the reader to bring their imagination to the process. You know, I found myself reading the text and then looking at the picture and going, oh, okay, fine, I get it now. You know, is that something that's important to you, that those little aha moments occur?
I think the secret in any book, but certainly in a book about technology, for the non-technological, the non-architectural, is you have to find ways of engaging the audience, whether it's verbal or visual. For me, it's easier to do visually. And it might be something as sort of obvious as changing perspective, of manipulating the point of view. Or it's something more subtle, like creating a certain rhythm in the book as you move from one image to another. But somehow, it is my job to draw people into this information so that, since I didn't invent the information, I see my job, in a sense, as translator, as guide through this stuff that already exists. My job is to translate it in a language which not only passes along information, but makes them interested in the information.
So in a way, that's the ultimate compliment when someone's reading along and goes, oh, that's how they did it.
It really is.
Let's go back to our phone lines now to Northborough, Massachusetts, where Eldad is on the line. I hope I'm getting your name right.
Pretty close. Thank you. Question about the book Unbuilding, where Saudi Arabian millionaires buy the Empire State Building, and Mr. McCauley makes a little comment in there about offering to take down the World Trade Center for free. I wonder if you could comment on that whole theme.
Isn't that odd?
Yeah.
I think about that these days. That was 1979. I think it was 79. Yes, it was part of the deal. I mean, I was never terribly fond of those two buildings, and they were perfect. A perfect butt for whatever kind of jokes anybody wanted to make because of their scale, because of their obviousness. It's only now, looking back 20 years, that it just seems strange. But it was part of the deal that those, in order to be able to buy and remove from Manhattan the Empire State Building, the purchaser would also have to agree to dismantle the World Trade Towers.
And do you look at the New York skyline now and miss them, even though you didn't particularly like the architecture at the time?
Personally, no. No, I don't miss the buildings. It's obviously far more complicated than that. But no, as architecture, they were a very practical solution to a problem of getting as much rentable space as possible in as small an area as possible. And what you end up with were two monsters, which from a distance, in the right light, looked quite remarkable. But I wouldn't want to have to live with them, to look at them from a distance. I remember flying around them, the flights from Providence to LaGuardia, and we circled around it. And it was always something amazing to see, the lengths of the shadows across the river into New Jersey. That was quite usually the morning flight. Quite an astounding thing. But as a piece of architecture, no, I'm separating there.
Hmm. Eldad, thanks for the call. David, I want to ask you about what you're working on now. You are now taking on the human body after all these years of bridges and tunnels and cathedrals and assorted buildings. Is that even more of a challenge than your previous work?
It's a huge challenge. I've never not done a project out of ignorance. I've just always said, okay, I'll learn it. Somehow I'll learn it. But I've also never felt quite as ignorant of the information, even though I've got one, as I do now. This is an astoundingly complicated thing. And if I get lost in the complexity of it, it won't work. What I have to do is come at it the way I come at all my projects and all the buildings and find a way of getting inside it myself, of beginning to understand it on a level that I think I can handle, and then finding a way of passing that on to my readers.
And after all of these years of writing about and illustrating human creations, I wonder if, as you're examining the marvels of the body, whether that makes human creations pale by comparison.
In some ways it does. I think the scale of this extraordinary machine piece of architecture, whatever you want to call it, we are, the scale of it is just astounding to me. And I keep sort of think about the format of this book and how I will have to be inventive and playful and so on and so forth. And then I keep doing my reading. I keep following up on the research. And you hardly have to play with it at all. It is more fantastic than anything I could possibly invent. The question is how to use it, how to make it accessible, and how to make it understandable. The hardest thing to communicate will be the sense of scale of a cell, of DNA. The comparisons. I mean, there are lots of comparisons that have already been created. How do you get it into people's heads in a way that they will go, wow, I'm amazing?
Well, we look forward to see how you solve that problem.
Thanks.
David McCauley, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
David's newest book is Mosque. And you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, one man worries about America's addiction to cell phones. This is On Point. James Madison High School in Brooklyn this week became the latest school to prohibit students from carrying cell phones on its campus. Saybrook College in Connecticut has outlawed cell phones from its dining halls, and restaurants from San Antonio to Chicago are telling customers yammering on their wirelesses to keep out. Illinois resident Steve Chapman would like to see more places ban cell phone use. In this radio diary, he wonders about America's addictions to their Motorolas.
One day I was at the gym, stretching on the floor next to the running track. The place was empty except for a jogger doing laps. So when I heard a voice, I couldn't figure out where it was coming from. Only after the runner had passed by a couple of times did I finally realize he was yakking on his cell phone. That was about the most unlikely occasion for a Nokia moment that I could imagine, but my imagination is clearly inadequate. The other day I walked into an airport restroom. There, someone was engaged in a lively chat from inside a toilet stall. By now we're all accustomed to seeing our fellow human beings making use of their cell phones while driving, walking down the sidewalk, riding the bus, standing in line at the grocery, sitting at a ball game, or sharing a meal in a restaurant. Cab drivers feel no compunction about carrying on phone conversations in strange tongues in the presence of passengers. But the few barriers of etiquette that once existed are rapidly disappearing. It's getting so no activity, occasion, or place is off limits. I hate to imagine what's next. Doctors calling their financial planners while performing surgery? Outfielders making dinner reservations during pitching changes? Brides answering the ring on the way up the aisle? It wouldn't surprise me to go to a funeral and see the pallbearers whip out phones as they lug the deceased to his final resting place. Come to think of it, I wouldn't be stunned to hear chirping from inside the casket. A long time ago, say about 1998, most people treated cell phones as handy gadgets which often made life easier. But today, many people have come to think of them the way heart patients regard their pacemakers, absolutely indispensable for day-to-day survival. They can no more refrain from using them than they can refrain from breathing. There are two regrettable phenomena at work here. One is the nagging sense of needing to be accessible by phone at all times. I rarely use my cell phone, but I get a pang any time I forget to bring it along when I'm running errands or commuting to work. What if the president needs my advice on Iraq and I'm not there to take the call? What if my kids want to ask who's buried in Grant's tomb? A colleague of mine was out one Saturday night with his wife when his local network went down. He didn't need to call anyone, but he shudders recalling the experience. I felt naked. I felt adrift at sea. I felt like my kids were home trashing the house and I couldn't check up on them. The other problem is that some people just can't stand to deprive themselves of electronic support systems even briefly. A true cell phone addict trembles at the prospect of going for, say, a half-hour jog and for that entire desolate period being cut off from wireless interaction. The feeling must be like what an alcoholic suffers when passing through a dry county. An overwhelming craving consumes the poor wretch, and he must do whatever he can to satisfy it. It's hard to believe that people once managed to fill these idle moments without hitting a send key. They read books or newspapers. They gazed out the window. They savored pleasant memories. They brooded over injustice. They pondered the mysteries of the universe. They wondered why no one had invented cell phones. Who knows what we're losing by depriving ourselves of occasional silence and solitude? If Isaac Newton had enjoyed access to the Verizon network, we might still be wondering why apples fall downward. Shakespeare would have composed nothing more than clever voicemail messages. Thanks to the incessant use of cell phones, we never have to be alone with our thoughts. You remember what thoughts are, right?
Steve Chapman is a columnist and editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune. He lives outside Chicago, Illinois. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sarah Cook. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.